Welcome to Psycho Killer, the one and only podcast for lovers of classic true crime. I'm Simon Ford, and in our last podcast, we explored the callous crimes of Dorothea Waddingham.
As a nurse, she was supposed to be an angel of mercy, but she preyed on the elderly and the vulnerable, poisoning a mother and daughter for money. She paid the ultimate price. Hanged for murder, despite being a mother of five children, including a six-month-old baby girl.
Dorothea Waddingham went to the gallows in 1936. She was hanged despite public protests and calls for the death sentence to be commuted to life imprisonment. Why did those appeals fall on deaf ears? Well, that's a very good question.
I'm Carl Cooper. I used to present the BBC Radio Nottingham Breakfast Show, but I'd never heard the story of Dorothea Waddingham or the women she poisoned with morphine, Louisa Bagley and her daughter Ada.
Carl, Pip Watts and I worked together at the BBC, and Jack Morell is a retired major crime detective with 30 years of police service. We've put our heads together to answer one question. Was Dorothea Waddingham herself a victim of a miscarriage of justice?
A number of aspects of Dorothea Waddingham's conviction concern me. First of all, she stood trial having admitted to administering morphine to Louisa and Ada Bagley during the inquest into their deaths. Because of that admission, as the crime writer Fenton Bresler puts it, Dorothea was as good as convicted before she went into court.
A quick reminder, under English law, an accused person doesn't have to prove they are innocent. It is the job of the prosecution to prove they are guilty.
Absolutely. And I'd like to know whether Dorothea's public confession at the inquest was sufficient evidence to hang her. Why did she say what she did? Was she lying to protect someone? Was she being blackmailed by Dr. Manfield, perhaps? Those questions were not asked. So I'd argue her conviction was unsafe because it was based on somewhat shaky confession evidence.
Well, you're right. There's no evidence to support your blackmail theory. And that confession, it wasn't made behind closed doors. Dorothea basically said she did it in front of the coroner and the inquest jury. She had, and I've read the Bresler article too, so I'll quote him, put one foot on the scaffold. Now, I sought legal advice to get to the bottom of your question, and as far as I'm aware, the law in England and Wales has always allowed convictions based solely on confession evidence. The exception is where the court is satisfied that the defendant is mentally incapable and the confession appears unconvincing to a point where a jury, properly directed, could not properly convict. And this would be a decision for the trial judge. The judge could similarly throw out the confession if they were satisfied that it had been obtained by driving a coach and horses through Pace, through duress, for example. Where the judge allows the confession to go to the jury, and there's no other evidence, they must direct the jury on the need for especial caution before convicting only on the strength of the confession.
Okay, what is Pace? Or rather, what does Pace stand for?
PACE is the Police and Criminal Evidence Act of 1984. It's what I was trained in, and every cop got a book called the PACE Codes of Practice. They establish the powers of the police to combat crime whilst protecting the rights of the public. And of course, they came into effect 48 years after Dorothea Waddingham's execution. But as I've said, she confessed in front of a packed inquest. He wasn't under duress. Plus, Dorothea's account to the coroner didn't amount to a confession to murder, only to causing the death, claiming she administered the doses on the basis of previous medical advice. There was, of course, some corroboration to her confession, something which most prosecutions will seek before proceeding. The prosecution in 1936 relied very much on her earlier lies to undermine her explanation for administering the drugs. it was strengthened by the circumstantial evidence, such as the fact of two deaths from morphia overdose, the dodgy will, the apparent health of Ada that afternoon, and Dr. Jacobs' account that she had not previously complained of being in pain.
So we're probably wrong to talk about a confession, but whatever Dorothea said, it couldn't be retracted. That's very interesting. Thanks for looking into it.
Look, I have a question about the amount of time it took, or rather didn't take, to convict Dorothea Waddingham. There were only 21 days, in fact, just 11 working days, between the end of the inquest on the 15th of January 1936 and the start of the trial on the 4th of February, with the police court hearing on the 28th of January. Was she railroaded? By which I mean convicted with undue haste.
Again, I checked with our legal friend, who's also something of an authority on the history of criminal law. The police hearing would have been the committal before the examining justices, and was no doubt referred to as the police court hearing, because the police used to present the case themselves, rather than rely on members of the legal profession. I used to know them as old-style committals, where some witnesses were called to test the strength of the case before it was sent to the Crown Court, and I think they were phased out in the 1990s. Going back to 1936, it's unclear whether there were concerns about the state of the evidence, but I was told that the case could have been stopped if a successful submission had been made at that stage.
And of course, that didn't happen.
Yeah, and then the defendant would have been committed for trial at the next Court of Assize. And in Nottingham, the Assize was held for 2 weeks in February and 2 weeks in July.
So, what, in the end, the interval between the inquest and the police court hearing, and the police court hearing and the trial, just followed a schedule?
That's about the size of it.
I've done a bit of digging into this. The defence asked for longer to prepare for trial. In fact, Dorothea's barrister, Mr. Eales, hadn't been briefed. But the request was denied by the trial judge, Lord Justice Goddard. So the trial took place in February. If they'd postponed until the July assize, the defence would have had 5 or 6 months to prepare the case. Added to this, the trial itself was held in Nottingham immediately after the inquest, and the newspaper reports were still fresh in people's minds. It would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, to select an unbiased jury. Nowadays, the trial would have been held in another town after a reasonable period had elapsed, allowing the publicity to fade into the background. It seems like the scales of justice were weighted against Dorothea.
I agree with you that if the matter was being dealt with today, the defence would be given a far greater opportunity to prepare for the trial. Most murder cases now take between 9 and 12 months to get to trial, and it may be that the case would have been tried somewhere other than Nottingham. But on paper, it would remain open to a jury today to reach the same verdict.
So the conviction seems sound. But what about the sentence? The jury recommended mercy, perhaps because of Dorothea's 5 children. She was breastfeeding her baby daughter, for goodness sake. But the trial judge, Mr. Justice Goddard, passed the death sentence anyway. And the Home Secretary, Sir John Simon, refused to commute it to life imprisonment. On the day of the execution, 12,000 people protested outside Winston Green Prison, chanting, "Stop this mother murder!" And still, they hanged her.
I agree, it was barbaric. However, the conviction appears to have been reviewed by the Court of Appeal, and the appeal against both conviction and sentence was dismissed. The comment by the Home Secretary that he could not advise clemency just because Dorothea was a woman certainly matches the view of the current Court of Appeal stance, that being a woman is not in itself a mitigating feature, unless she's a mother with children who solely depend on her. And, of course, we no longer hang murderers in the United Kingdom.
So what happened to Dorothea's baby and her 4 other kids? Did her partner Ronald Sullivan look after them?
Well, I'm afraid not. Sullivan remained alone in the deserted nursing home, and then he left. according to the crime historian Fenton Bresler, the children were split up. Nowadays, prisoner Waddingham would still have parental responsibility, but with that, she would have the rights to make decisions on her children's care. She could also have children who were under 18 months stay with her in what's called a mother and baby unit. The decisions in 1936 would have been very different. The children might have been adopted. They might have gone into orphanages. We just don't know. Maybe we should do more digging. If the baby survived, she would be, what, 86 years old?
I think there's much more to this story than meets the eye. Dorothea Waddingham's conviction appears to be sound, but her execution was a milestone on the road to the abolition of capital punishment in the United Kingdom. She was a wicked woman. She murdered two defenceless victims, but it didn't end there. Her own children suffered the consequences of her actions. And then there's Ronald Sullivan. Was he a victim, or did he just save his own skin?
You guys can be the judge of that one. Let us know. On Twitter, we're at PsychoKillerPO. That's all one word, at PsychoKiller, P for Papa, O for Oscar.
If you'd like to contribute financially to our investigations, head over to buymeacoffee.com and search PsychoPals. Thank you very much in advance for your generosity.
We'll see you again soon on the dark side for another PsychoKiller classic true crime story.